Hello and welcome to a new episode of The Sound of Finance, a podcast by ZDB Consulting. In today's episode, it is once again about one of the most pressing topics of our time. It's climate protection, and in particular, the role financial services can play in driving credible and measurable impact. Apparently, these days, the question is no longer whether to act, I guess, but how to do so in a way that is both effective and defensible. And this is exactly where today's topic comes in, being the role of high-quality carbon credits and the integrity of the voluntary carbon market. To discuss this, I'm very happy to be joined by Adrian Wons from Senken. And I guess we have much to talk about. It's going to be about the startup he founded, about the European Emission Trading System, ETS, versus the voluntary carbon market his business is about. We will have to talk about greenwashing and science-based targets. And finally, obviously, about concrete examples for financial services institutions. So, Adrian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Johannes. It is quite an international market, right? Because most of the projects so far, they come from the global south. Mm-hmm. But obviously, especially for the global north, it's a really important instrument to achieve the climate goal. But yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So talking about the importance, let me maybe start with a broader question. Maybe it's just my gut feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, but climate protection somehow feels like it has become more difficult in recent years, politically, economically. I mean, given the recent geopolitical developments in the US with their, let's call it, the science hostile policy, I'm actually wondering if these movements are slowing things down with respect to climate protection, or perhaps even acting as an additional trigger for action elsewhere in Europe, for instance, or South Africa, where you are based. So from your perspective, how much genuine willingness is still out there today when it comes to net zero ambitions compared to, say, 6-7 years ago in the days of Fridays for Future movements and so on?
Yeah, so very good question. So first of all, we have to say climate protection and market-based instruments around climate protection are actually nothing new, right? So they started in 1997 with the Kyoto Protocol, where actually your first kind of market around carbon credits, CO2 certificates, and climate protection started. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely say that market is a pretty much a roller coaster ride. With ups and downs. And I think especially beginning 2021, we actually were quite on a up, all the way up on the roller coaster. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a lot of hope. There was also maybe a little bit of hype, especially around climate neutral labels, but then also in general, sustainability was a really big topic, right? And also a global topic. So from that hype of the all the way at the top of the roller coaster, we went down again. And where do we stand today? I think especially with the US and a lot of right movement globally, we definitely lost some of the pace, some of the momentum, especially with the US exiting the Paris Agreement, which try to also figure out carbon markets on a mm-hmm. global level, especially mm-hmm. the trade between countries. So especially for countries that maybe will not be able to create enough carbon sinks within their own country, that they can then buy carbon sinks or carbon credits from other countries that maybe overproduce, especially countries in the global south. Mm-hmm. So they exited the Paris Agreement, and that means one of the big players is not in the market anymore. But, and here's a big but, Europe still stands quite strong, I would say.
Okay.
So yeah. It's part of the almost European identity of corporates that they actually, especially around climate protection, I still see this as a really important topic. And also one of the only tools to achieve net zero. obviously there's a couple of tools, and the biggest one is reducing your own footprint. But I think after the whole hype around sustainability, now there's a lot of clarity that they understand way better how much they can reduce and how much they won't. And for that, they need to use carbon credits. And then obviously we have the EU ETS. There was, over the last weeks, a lot of talks around changing the EU ETS, but there's actually, it has been confirmed that the EU ETS will be one of the big instruments. And we're going to talk about that later. There's a big correlation, or no, not correlation, there's a big overlap coming probably between the voluntary markets or the CO2 certificates that you mostly heard about, climate CO2 certificates coming from climate projects, and the EU ETS that is mostly run on allowances that almost, it's not 100% the same, works a little bit like a tax where companies get free allowances, but then they run out and then they have to pay and buy allowances, and there's a certain amount of allowances being given out. And that is then basically the revenue generated through that is funneled back to the countries. And there's a big thing coming up in June, a big decision if voluntary carbon credits should be included in the ETS. And this is at the moment standing, and that's the reason Europe is still quite big on the climate protection side. But it is a global effort. So even if Europe is very strong, we need more. And we see that a little bit coming from China, Brazil, so other big countries building their national markets. But yeah, the US definitely is putting a lot of friction in this global market.
Yeah, got you. So even more important that you are active in this realm. So as you mentioned, we will talk about ETS later on, but maybe let's focus first on the other side of the coin, the voluntary market. So let's talk about what you are building. Could you briefly explain what Zenken does in simple terms? And I'm also curious about the idea behind the name Zenken. So maybe for the German-speaking audience is self-explanatory, but there is a thought behind this name, right? And maybe also tell me what personally motivated you to start the company.
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, my background is, I'm like any other German, an engineer, right? No, so I started in automotive engineering, then later went into wind energy, and then went into consulting. And at a certain point, I didn't do anything with sustainability anymore, which is why I concentrated on wind energy at a certain point. So I went into a big research project into South Africa. I started a research institute for a German university. Went to South Africa, and I had this big task of figuring out what would incentivize farmers in the Southern Hemisphere to switch to regenerative agriculture. And they also had money, obviously. and then I asked them, where does the money come from? And they said, yeah, maybe development banks. Like in Germany, you have the GIZ. Or from carbon markets. But then they said, yeah, carbon markets is amazing, but they don't work. They feel a little bit shady. The money is not arriving, and so on and so forth. They're not really structured. So that's when I then thought about, like, okay, if they're all saying this is one of the main tools that would finance the transition, then, and it's not working, then we need a solution for that, right? So I was there in South Africa. Actually, I got stranded due to COVID and the South African Omicron variant, and I couldn't fly back to Germany. And what do? You start a company, right?
Apparently.
So that was 5 years ago. And then I started Zenken with the aim basically to make this market a market that companies can trust and that helps projects to actually start with climate protection. And there was regenerative agriculture in the beginning, but now basically we're helping companies to tap into that market without the greenwashing concerns. So what we are doing is we basically take that concept of that market that makes a lot of sense, right? You finance climate projects on the ground, and it has always been like, I think almost no one says that we don't need that. I think it's more about like the structure and the flaws that market had, being transparent, not knowing that the money arrives, not knowing, okay, what is going on after my money went to the project. So what we did is basically we created an AI module for different kind of project types like reforestation, regenerative agriculture, mangroves, but also new things like direct air capture that analyzes these projects and sees, okay, which project is actually doing good for the planet, which project has impact, and then also continuously monitor them. And by that, we help companies to actually invest in these projects without greenwashing problems and challenges afterwards, but then also to manage that like a portfolio. So there we come a little bit into the finance world. We don't just think you should get a PDF and then you're fine and you're like, hey, I support it. No, you should actually manage this like a portfolio with different kind of project types, different kind of risk profiles, and also maybe with longer term investments, but also with the risk profiles that every project has. And that's what we're doing now with a little bit more than 40 people with big clients like Deutsche Telekom, Vodafone, Vorwerk, but also in the financial industry like DZ Bank, or Union Investment, or E&V Versicherung, or Hanse Merkur. So we're quite big actually in the financial industry.
Gotcha. Okay. So you were saying the carbon, the voluntary carbon market is quite shady at the moment. So why do we see such large differences in quality between the certificates? And so how can it be that these questionable certificates sometimes appear to be audit compliant? So what makes this business that shady and still working as well?
So first of all, I started a company 5 years ago. I think quite some changes happened in the meantime. I wouldn't say it's that bad anymore. But basically how it started is that 5 years ago, there was almost no technology being used to verify projects. So you can literally imagine it that someone from TÜV flies to a forest in Kenya and then measures with a tape the diameter of a tree.
Okay.
So this is basically how it's used to be. And also the standards are basic. They were quite outdated and they were made for a world where there's no digitalization. None. And now only over time, we saw that there is more and more data being used, which makes a lot of sense because if you only can measure, like, let's say you measure 20 trees and then you say, okay, for the other 5 million trees, it's probably going to be the same. It's going to be a pretty bad assumption. So now with satellite data and LIDAR data and other data points and then AI basically making sense of that data pool, you obviously you get way closer to the truth. So this is something that we're doing. And the standards, they are slowly and also doing that, like the big standards. I don't know if you heard about them, like Gold Standard or Vera and so on. They're slowly adapting to that. But it takes a lot of time because rewriting a standard takes a couple of years and then it needs to go through all the different instances on audits and so on. So basically from the beginning to implementing a new standard, it can be like 5 years.
So even
though all these things came up in 2021, 2022, and these claims that projects, you know, like a lot of the projects didn't have that impact, then they started writing new standards, but now they're only coming out these new standards. So a lot of the projects are still happening under the old standards. And but it doesn't mean it's a bad or a good project. It's a really shallow, I would say, bar to cross, you know?
So I see.
That's the problem at the moment. And that's the reason it needs like additional proof. Even though TÜV is basically auditing these projects, but if the requirements are so low, then the TÜV still says, yeah, all these requirements happened, but they don't say it's a good or a bad project. Right, they only say, yes, this standard has been executed in this project, but yeah. not this is a very good project.
Okay, and so you are fulfilling the science-based standards by combining it with a lot of data, I guess. So is there already a role that AI plays in making better decisions here, or
100%.
How do you handle all the data?
AI is a big thing because, look, there are, I'm not sure, 10,000 projects out there. Mm-hmm. And all these projects have a lot of data points, obviously. First of all, they all have so-called PDDs, project description. And these are already like PDFs of like 600, 700 pages.
Oh, wow.
Okay. They are audited. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously still the manual work. But then you have additional data, maybe even public data, like satellite data and so on, that you can use for analysis. But in the beginning, we actually started without AI. Mm-hmm. It took like one of our scientists like 3 weeks for one single project full-time to go through all the data. And then there's still a massive chunk of human error because you would still... say, I check 10% of the satellite data and I trust the rest, so to say. Now what we can do, like we've built up these modules for different project types. Now it basically takes an hour per project to analyze it because we're now at like almost 90% that's completely automized. Mm-hmm. Through AI, we take satellite data, we take all the documents and so on. Mm-hmm. And then we put it into our module and then it's being analyzed. And then there will still be things coming up where our scientists then have to check themselves. For instance, they say this and this data can't be 100% analyzed, or here there's no data. Okay. So we either have to go back to the project, or we have to the project at the end. We also have to go still there in person, because especially a lot of things around social and biodiversity, sometimes you can't, there's no sensor data.
Okay, so it's part of your daily business that your colleagues go into a rainforest or...
100%.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah,
so that's a daily business. But the thing is, if you just think about this 10,000 project pipeline, we already can say for like 85 to 90%, we don't even have to visit them because they will never make it past our due diligence. Mm-hmm. So then in the end, you only have like a small percentage of projects left that you actually look at.
Okay, so you already got a seventh sense, so to say, for shady projects where you already say this is not worth it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the thing is, it's still shocking, but we're in between 90 and 95% of the projects we look at, they still don't make our due diligence. So it's still on the bad side. It gets better year by year. Mm-hmm. I must say our quality gate is quite strict. It's maybe because we're from Germany and the German companies in general, they're quite sensitive on like auditing and then greenwashing risk and so on, and especially even more so in the financial industry. So that's the reason, it's still in between 90 and 95. But it also shows you in what state the market is. In general, newer projects tend to have better outcomes. Obviously, it's not like software where you can go from 0 to 1. Mm. It's you start a project and then only 4 years later, you get the first credit. So there's a big ramp up phase.
Maybe financial services is a key word to make your business a bit more tangible. So, and it's the core audience of this podcast as well. So, let's consider if I'm a bank or an asset manager, I might ask myself, why should I even engage in voluntary carbon markets? I mean, especially given that most of my emissions are scope 3, so they sit in my portfolio rather in my own operations, running the bank, the building itself, and so on, right? So wouldn't it be more effective to simply focus on decarbonizing my portfolio itself, like adjusting lending or investment decisions? So convince me, why should I engage in these voluntary carbon markets?
So you can look at it from different perspectives. And the first perspective is always looking at the scale this market will have to be. If you look at the renewable energy space, I think we're at like $2 trillion market, which is 2 billion in German, right? Billion and trillion is different. But so the 2 trillion market at the moment. And if we now look how much CO2 we actually have to remove from the atmosphere to reach net zero, we already in 2040 will have, if we say a carbon removal will cost around $100, the market in 2040 will also be 2 trillion. If we now say, okay, for every financial institution, the renewable energy market is one of the hottest markets right now, then we know for certain that in 2040, it will have the same size. And that's already something I think is really, really interesting, because also in the renewable energy market, financial services are super interesting, right? So from financing these projects to insure this project, but then also to decarbonize my scope 3, right? So this is basically the same kind of thesis around carbon removal, because we in the world, we will not be able to reduce all our footprint to zero. And for everything that's still there, so the unavoidable or the residual emissions, there we need carbon removal.
But yeah, to put it provocatively, isn't it a sort of surrender to say we won't be able at all to decarbonize our industry and so on? So we take this easy exit of carbon sinks?
I think in the past, this was mainly the main topic, right? The main thing that we talked about. But here's why that was the main topic. In the past, I think it was still quite easy to avoid carbon footprints. It was cheap. What I mean by that is, like, you change from like an old light bulb to neon or something like that. Or
the low-hanging fruits, right?
Low-hanging fruits. It costs you maybe, let's say, 5 euros per ton of CO2. So now we are more on the times when I talk to my customers, we are at times where it costs like 20 to 30 euros. Let's play this game all the way to the end. If we have a proper carbon management strategy within a company, then you will always look like, how much would it cost me to remove the, or like to reduce this ton of CO2? And at a certain point, if we come towards the last 20, 30%, depending on the industry, we will look at more like $200 to $5,000 per ton of CO2, especially if we look at like automotive. But even if you look at aviation, we see, okay, you can switch from normal fuel to sustainable aviation fuel, but the prices for that is around $2,000 to $8,000 per ton of CO2. Then if you come to this point and you properly manage price against ton of CO2, at a certain point, we will just be where it makes no sense to reduce anymore, because it costs you so much. From an atmosphere perspective, it makes way more sense to rather invest in carbon removal, where you know, so that's obviously the premise. We need to know that it's definitely stored, the CO2, and it's safely and securely stored. But if it then only costs you 100 or 200, then it makes way more sense from an economical perspective to rather invest $100 or $200 instead of $5,000. And that's we actually come to a point where it makes sense to have these thoughts running. At what point does it not make sense to reduce anymore? Because economically, it would be just not smart, where I could maybe instead remove 20 tons. Why should I reduce one ton? I think a lot of companies are not there yet, but as soon as you get there, then your mindset around carbon removal will change drastically.
Interesting, because I was indeed thinking about this economic rationality. I was rather supposing that what actually motivates banks to act voluntarily is maybe more driven by idealism or reputational considerations, right? So are we already at this point today that there is some economic rationale behind engaging in this voluntary market?
I think at the moment, we're still quite in the beginning, because 2021, where everyone did something, these credits that had not a lot of impact, they were really cheap. Think 1 euro, 2 euro, 3 euro per credit. If you suddenly can say you're climate neutral with spending, let's say, 20,000 euros because your footprint was 20,000 tons and the credit was only 1 euro, then this is marketing budget. You're like, ah, let's just do it, whatever.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But if it suddenly changes to the credit costs me 100 euro, then it's 2 million euros. A budget that jumps from 20K to 2 million quickly is obviously that hurts, right? So it's not a marketing budget anymore. It comes more a compliance budget. So that's that was the moment where people then were like, oh shit, maybe we can't stick to that target that we set ourselves anymore if we suddenly have to invest into high quality projects. You could still do this less than 100 euros, let's say. A portfolio can cost 40 euros or 50, but it's not 2 euros anymore.
Yeah.
So what a lot of companies now did is that they either changed their goals or then, they maybe recall, they call it differently. There has been a lot of change due to that. So I think what's happening at the moment is that a lot of companies trying to find what a goal is that makes sense for them, that's achievable with this new cost in mind. Or they see this a little bit as a learning journey. Why? Because everyone knows the end state. Everyone knows, oh, I know in 2000, whenever they set a goal, or they know for latest in 2045 or 2050, depending on what goal they stick, if it's the German goal or just general net zero. They know the end state. If I reduce my footprint 90%, I will have this and this amount left, and I will have to spend this and this amount of money. So for a lot of them, it's also learning, trying to figure out that market, because it's not easy to steer like a massive undersupply of credits from the good ones. And also a lot of like forward-thinking companies already locking in 10-year, 15-year contracts with these projects, so they know they will get the credits for a certain price when they need it.
I see.
So I think it's just in between. Either they still have to fulfill some goals, or it's learning. I think this is the two things. I think we don't see that much anymore where companies just want to show we're really great, we're a front leader, because it's just too expensive. It's not a marketing budget anymore.
I think that's a good sign, actually. So as far as I know, this goes hand in hand with the increasing regulatory pressure on the non-voluntary market. We were mentioning ETS already. So do you expect a stronger convergence between voluntary market and the regulated systems like the EU emission trading system, which we see very often in the news these days?
The convergence was what a lot of financial companies are betting on, actually, because I think we already see some banks being really active in the EU ETS with their own trading desks. But also they maybe see it from the investments they have in the portfolio, where some companies maybe have to participate already in that market. And the convergence is actually already happening, but not in the EU ETS yet. Where is it happening? For instance, in California or in South Africa. In California, they also have an ETS, and they are, I think, between 10 and 20% of the allowances that they have to buy, they can also buy from the voluntary carbon market instead. But the projects need to be in the States. And the same in South Africa. In South Africa, they actually have a carbon tax. So they have a carbon tax, I think it's like 10 euros at the moment. I'm not sure if they increase it this year. Maybe it's 12.
Per ton of CO2
for certain kind of industries. And what they are allowed to is that they buy national carbon credits from the voluntary carbon market to be tax exempt. And obviously, from a financial perspective, this is insanely interesting because this opens up so many arbitrage potential, right? If you can create a project that is can issue credits cheaper than the tax, then you have a margin to make, right? So this is super interesting. Also, you have a floor price for any investment. You know, if your project or your investment, it will always sell for the carbon tax price. So this is super interesting because the market is chronically undersupplied. So you will always be able to sell your credit There are just not enough projects. So there are already examples for that. And the UK ETS also going to introduce something like that in 2028. And now the European Union thinks about the same in 2031. And this is super, super interesting because it is a massive flexibility mechanism. And corporates actually love flexibility in the ETS markets. So yeah, I'm really curious the way they're going to integrate it. Mm-hmm. But they definitely need it because the EU ETS is also built, it's deflationary. So it's built in a way that at a certain point there will be no more allowances and then they will need to switch to something else. And that probably is carbon removal.
So at least to me, you sound quite optimistic. So maybe to close this episode on a personal note, I guess you will very likely survive these crucial dates of 2050 or 2045 when these net zero goals are or should be fulfilled. So how optimistic are you in the long term when you think about the next 20 to 30 years in terms of global climate progress and also the role of your business of the voluntary carbon market? So will we reach net zero in our lifetime? Is it a feasible goal?
So, I mean, I'm a startup founder. I have to be an optimist.
For sure.
There's no other way. Otherwise, I would not survive daily business. But how do I look at the market? So I'm really optimistic to know what will be the end state. But where I'm really pessimistic at the moment is the in-between state. Why? A lot of companies, they just write in their sustainability goals and reports that, hey, we want to achieve net zero in 2024, and then we will neutralize our unavoidable emissions with carbon removal. And that makes a lot of sense, but it actually doesn't make sense. Why do I say it doesn't make sense? Because that's not how the world operates. We have a carbon budget, and it's quite clear how much in this budget is left. And if we not scale carbon removal and carbon sink potential beforehand, then there will just not be enough carbon sinks available when all the companies in the world suddenly decide to be net zero.
Yeah.
So we actually need a ramp-up phase. Mm-hmm. And also the IPCC actually says exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Hey, we need to ramp up carbon removal now. And we have to slowly ramp it up to net zero so that it's there. And the standards have not properly aligned on how this should be done. If you look, for instance, at SBTI, so Science-Based Targets Initiative, this is where a lot of companies are signed up for or at least look at for net zero goals. They also acknowledge that, and now there's a new version coming out this year where they want to make it mandatory, that scale up of carbon removal. But this is where I'm really pessimistic at the moment. We need some more scale up regulation in between. And that's the reason I'm obviously an optimist, but I think I'm still, there's not enough ambition still on a global level to close that gap so that this carbon budget is not running out before we even achieve net zero.
Okay, yeah, that's a very important thing. So let's take this with us as a call for action. Thank you for this assessment. So Adrian, many thanks for your time and sharing your insights. This has been, I think, a very thoughtful and nuanced discussion, and also to our audience, thank you for listening to this episode of The Sound of Finance. If you enjoyed the conversation, feel free to subscribe and share it with your colleagues, and see you soon in the next episode. Goodbye, Adrian.
Thanks, Jonas. Bye-bye.